and not a word was...
Not a word was said between us when we walked into the principal's office. There was Dr. Springer. And Dr. James introduced, of course I said hello to him, Dr. James introduced Brummer to him, and then explained to Brummer that he sent for Dr. Springer because Dr. Springer in grade school cured me of stammering. And he wanted Dr. Springer to tell Brummer what the technique was. And he explained it to him. He said, now that Dr. Brummer understands, I'm sure he'll give Perlow enough time to recite, and that was it. And we went upstairs. When we went upstairs, I went to my seat and I sat down, and Brummer sat down at his desk and he put his fist in his mouth. Have you ever heard how an Italian swears out a vendetta? That's what they do. At somebody's funeral, when they swear to kill somebody, they swear out a vendetta. They put their fist in their mouth.
Oh my.
Hold it that way. And that's what Brummer did to me. And while he was sitting at his desk, tears came out of his eyes and ran down his cheeks. And for the rest of the period, that's all we did. Everybody sat there and looked, and he sat at his desk with tears coming down. And so the next period when we came in, he took the attendance and he said, "Perlow." And I stood up and he asked me a question. He said, "Now take a deep breath. Now." he was trying to ridicule me. But that's the best thing he could have done to me. Because up until that time, I was in fear of getting up and reciting. But when he did that, every recitation, but I knew that he had something up his sleeve and that he was going to get me. So anything I knew my history lesson. I studied it from beginning to end because every question he asked me was on the first paragraph of the assignment. But I knew sooner or later he'd switch to the end, thinking
right.
that I wouldn't be
prepared.
I wouldn't be ready for him. So, sure enough, that's what happened. He asked me a question that came from the last, that I think was the last paragraph in the assignment, or next to the last, and he had a smug expression on his face, I can't forget it, and I said, he said, "Now," and I started to breathe. No, I started to take a deep breath. He said, "Now," and I started to recite. He says, "That's enough." And he sat down at his desk again with his fist in his mouth and glared at me that way because, you know, I crossed him up. Many years later, I had some visitors come through from Brooklyn, and I took them out up to Mount Washington, and we parked down at the base, mm-hmm. you know, at the point, and then we went up on the incline, and when we came back on the incline, we had to get the car. So we stood in line, and while standing in line, the fellow in front of us turns around and says to the fellow in back of us, we were evidently between these two fellows, he says, "We never had anything like this happen in New York." So, you know, they had to wait that long. I said, "What part of New York are you from?" He says, "Brooklyn." I said, "What part of Brooklyn?" He said, "Bronzeville." I said, "That's where I'm from, Bronzeville." says, yeah. I said, yeah, I'm from Brownsville. He said, what school did you go to in Brownsville? I said, well, I came to Pittsburgh to go to Pitt, but I went to Boys High. And, well, did you go to Boys High? Did you ever know a teacher there by the name of Brummer?
Oh, my.
After all that time. But, you know, he had everybody scared to death. And what actually happened to him, the second year at Christmas time, you know, the fellows, all the alumni would come back the day before Christmas and say hello to the teachers and so on. You know, Brummer wouldn't say hello to me. I extended my hand to him and he turned away from me. And he should never been entrusted at taking
students.
Care of kids.
Right.
And he had a stroke in school and died in school before he got to the hospital. Mm. But this technique of taking a deep breath, Mrs. Roosevelt said that when she gets up to address a group, wonderful speaker, she says she's always scared to death. Her heart pounds, and before she's able to speak, she has to take a deep breath or two. She didn't have, Springer didn't have the explanation, but what he told me was correct.
Mm-hmm.
And experts in speech now get every public speaker and impress upon them when they get up to speak, not to start talking right away, but to take a deep breath, another one. And the explanation is that when you get up to address a group, no matter how experienced you are, your heart starts beating because you're a little bit frightened and you develop carbon monoxide. And the exchange must be made, oxygen for carbon monoxide. And that's what Springer impressed upon me way back in grade school.
You were very lucky to come across
I certainly
a man
was.
Like that.
If I didn't have Springer, I'd have ended up in the school for the dumb.
What was the grade school? What was the name of the grade school?
The number.
What was it, PS something?
Yeah, PS 84. PS 84B for
and
boys.
Then Dr. Springer went on to become the principal of what school?
I don't know.
Yeah, no.
I don't know what the other school was.
Were these public schools that were boys' schools and girls' schools?
Yeah, 84 was one. It was divided. I went to 84B and there was 84G.
I see.
You know, boys and girls.
Uh-huh.
And they had different principals.
You said that you met with him on Saturday.
A Saturday morning.
You were Orthodox, weren't you?
Yeah.
And so your parents allowed you to do
this?
Oh,
yeah, yeah. I want to tell you, the Orthodox Jews, the younger ones in Brownsville, they didn't worry about going to the synagogue on Saturdays. They went twice a year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur.
Really?
Sure.
I always thought it was a very religious area.
No. On Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And that gave rise to the statement, when are Jewish people not allowed to eat in Jewish restaurants? On Yom Kippur. Because they had to go out of the neighborhood to find a restaurant that was open. I'm telling you things you never heard
before.
Yeah,
that's right. That's wonderful.
Did we talk to you about your brothers and sisters? You say you have your sister Jenny, Ida, Betty, but you mentioned a brother.
Max.
And he was older than you.
He's older than I am. He's living.
Where is he living?
In Brooklyn. A Long Island, actually. That section that we lived in, that's all black now, the entire neighborhood has become black, and all the people that lived there moved out to suburban Long Island.
Were you born in a hospital?
Oh, no. I was born in a tenement house.
What year was that?
1901, January.
January what?
January the 25th, 1901.
That's my birthday, January 25th.
Is it really?
1946. Happy birthday.
You picked a good day.
Absolutely.
That's what kept you so long. I'll be 83 in January.
Sure. 1984, 83. That's easy to remember.
Were you delivered by a midwife? By a doctor?
Midwife. When I was born, my mother made $15 on my birth.
How is that?
Why?
She paid the midwife $5, but the man that owned the tenement house, he gave a gift to every woman who had a baby of $20.
He was a nice landlord.
Yes, he was. He was.
When you talk about Mrs. Roosevelt and her giving speeches, you're talking about Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yeah, it's Eleanor Roosevelt.
Okay. I think you want to ask about Pitt now when we're still talking about schools.
Mm-hmm. You say you came to Pittsburgh to go to Pitt.
That's right.
How did you hear about it?
After I got out of high school, I went to City College in New York for 2 years, and then I quit. And I worked for 2 years.
Doing
I sold
what?
Shoes. Mm-hmm. And I had a friend who went to Syracuse and went into social work.
Was your father still living at this time?
Oh, yes. He went into social work. He graduated from Syracuse. And just at the time he graduated, I decided I was going to go back to school. And and that in itself, the fellow that pushed me back into school was a nice old fellow. He was the manager of a Frank Brothers shoe store on Fifth Avenue in New York, and that's where I sold shoes. I was coming back from lunch one day, and he said to me, his name was Jacobs, he said to me, "Come here, I want to talk to you." I had no idea what he wanted, and I went over. He says to me, "What do you expect to do the rest of your life, sell shoes?" And I said, "I never gave it much thought." He said, "Well, you better start thinking about it, or you'll end up looking like Weinberg and Brickell." Those were the two other salesmen in my department. He said, "They've been selling shoes all their lives, and that's the way you're going to end up." He said, "If you can go back to school, did you ever think of taking a profession?" I said, "Well, I was thinking of studying dentistry." He says, "Well, go to school and study dentistry. You'll be better off." And so I wrote to Bob Roeder, who was in Syracuse, and took this job in Pittsburgh as the boys' worker at the Iron Kaufman Settlements.
What is that, a boys' worker?
In charge of the boys' clubs.
Oh, okay.
And
what year was that, do you remember?
Sure, 1921. And so I wrote to Bob Roeder and I told him, "I was thinking of going back to dental school, going back to school, I was going to go to the dental school, but I wanted to leave New York because I had a feeling that I'd never finish. See, everybody I went to school with was already graduated from college, and I'd be a schoolboy." So, I knew I'd never be able to finish it, going to school. So he wrote back to me and he said, "You want to come to Pittsburgh? I can get you a job at the Iron Kaufman Settlement working at the school in the office."
Was this Mr. Broder from Pittsburgh?
No, he was from Brooklyn.
But was he the one who went to Syracuse?
He went to Syracuse. And then he took a job.
Here.
Yeah, in Pittsburgh. So I wrote to him and I said, "Fine, I came to Pittsburgh. I matriculated at Pitt, and I lived at the Aaron Kaufman Settlement while I went to school, and I worked every evening and every Sunday.
Did you go right into dentistry then, or did you have to finish college first?
No. I had 2 years of City College,
uh-huh.
and that was enough at that time. At that time, you only needed 2 years of pre-dental work.
And then how many years did it take you to graduate with in dentistry?
4. I started in fall of 21, graduated in 25.
And did you, at that time, meet your wife?
Oh, yes, I met her at the Aaron Kaufman Settlement. Interestingly enough, I was introduced to everybody at the settlement except my wife.
What was she doing?
She was on vacation when I started to work there. And when I came back from school one day, she was in the office looking in the boxes, you know, where the mail was. And I looked at her and I said, I don't think I met you. I'm Ben Perlow. She says, I'm Anna Lauf. That's the way I met my wife.
Was she there to participate in the activities, or was she teaching?
She was a graduate of Pitt. And she came to the settlement to do the musical work, you know, choral work and so on. Mm-hmm. And while doing that, she started to give a couple of individual lessons in piano. And that led to her forming the music school at the Aaron Kaufman Settlement. And when she got, there was such a demand for piano lessons that she got a couple of people to help her. And and then she made a trip from New Jersey to Philadelphia and had a conference with a man by the name of Grawley, who ran a music school in Philadelphia. And she came back and organized a music school in 1925.
We'll get back to her a little later, because I do want to ask you more questions
what I wanted to tell you about her, of course, you know, they named the music school for
that
her.
That was a question that I have. Why is it the Anna M. Perlow?
Anna L. Perlow.
I thought it was Anna Lauf. I thought
Anna
it was
Lauf
Anna M.
Perlow. No.
Oh, okay. Anna B. L. Perlow. What?
I thought you had told me Anna B.
Anna B. Perlow.
So it's Anna L. Perlow.
Perlow. That's right.
Okay, because someone had said to me that it was Anna.
Well, then the L makes sense. It was
right,
Anna Lauf.
Perlow.
Perlow. Right. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your family health. Basically, was your family a healthy family? Did they live a long time? How old was your father, your mother, when they died?
My father was 77 when he died.
You remember what year that was?
My mother was 62. My mother always, as far as I remember, had a very high blood pressure. And finally had a stroke and died. My older sister had a very high blood pressure. And she had a very high blood pressure. She had a stroke and died. And all through life, I was inclined to have a high blood pressure. And it was only in the last 15 years that I was able to bring it down, and that is what, you know, a physician was able to bring it down, and I've kept it down.
Is that due to modern medicine? The miracles of modern medicine? You mentioned, we'll go into courtship and marriage now. Is there anything that you feel that we should, that I didn't cover about?
There was one
years?
Question I wanted to ask you. When you said you lived at the
Irene Kaufman Settlement,
where was it and how did you live there?
The settlement was a family. It was a family of social workers. And The Irene Kaufman settlement was on Center Avenue on the hill, and there were 22 workers who lived on the top floor. It was run on a hotel basis, and we had all our meals there, and there was a housekeeper employed. The Board of Trustees, I have to use a cough drop. Can I help you?
No, thanks.
Thank you.
I'm just getting over a sore throat.
I remember you saying that.
Me too. For 3 weeks.
I was in bed for 3 days this past week.
There's so much going around.
I don't know what's going around, but...
A change of weather, too.
Maybe, that probably is what it is.
But the fifth floor of the Irene Kaufman settlement was a family. All the social service workers connected with the settlement lived up there. The director, the assistant director, everybody lived there. I was for 3 years, I was the only volunteer that lived there.
What kind of things were you in charge of?
I was a hello girl at night.
What is a hello girl?
I answered the telephone and took messages. Mm-hmm.
And on the weekends?
The same thing on Sunday, mm-hmm. all day Sunday.
And you took messages for the other workers?
That's right. Or connected them with.
All right, so you said that you met your wife, Anna Lauf, one day at work. And then tell us a little bit about your courtship.
Then we started running around together. And, you know, the courtship in those days wasn't like it is with people today. People today have to have cars, and they have to go out to nightclubs or out-of-town restaurants. We just went by streetcar, and we'd go to a movie, and then stop and get a hot dog.
Where was she living at the time?
East End, Highview Street. That's near Highland Park.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you court her before you got married?
Well, I met her in 21, and we were married in 26.
It was a long time.
Oh, sure. In those days, you didn't get married until you had an income. It isn't, you know,
right.
Today it's different. But in those days, you had to have somewhat of an income to get married.
When you graduated from Pitt and became a dentist, did
yeah,
you still live
right.
at the Irene Kaufman settlement when you started your practice?
Right across the street from the settlement. So I had a tremendous number of people who came, you know, into the settlement, and I knew them, and I used to sell the membership cards. So that's where I met the people.
And these people became your patients?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that you lived and worked across the street from the settlement.
That's not a bad deal. Mm-hmm. You had a ready-made population then for your practice.
Pretty good, yeah. It worked out that way.
Did you have to buy your own equipment at that time? Did you open up your own practice, or were you with someone else?
No, opened. Actually, what happened, there was a faculty member at Pitt, Dr. Molly Foster. Ever hear the name?
Mm-mm.
She opened an office right across from the settlement, and then she got married. And she was a demonstrator at Pitt.
Demonstrator of what?
In dentistry.
Oh,
in the,
okay.
So she decided that she'd better sell the office. It was all brand new equipment. She just opened it. So I bought the office from her.
Mm. Where did you get the money to buy it?
I had to borrow some of it. In fact, most of it. Of course, it didn't run in the amounts. If I remember correctly, the whole office ran about $1,400.
My gracious. But in those days, that was an awful lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then...
I'll tell you something that may that may surprise you. We never bought an automobile. Does that surprise you?
Never.
Never.
Hmm?
You mean
never? Never. Never owned an automobile.
Even today?
That's right.
How do you get around today?
I get around. I used to do a lot of walking. I used to walk from here into town and back home again. That was my recreation. But things have happened to me in the last few years. And my wife used to walk with me from here into town. But what has happened, we were married in 26, and that's when everybody had a financial jag on. We went to a bridge party one day, and I asked the host if I could use his telephone to call a cab. And everybody said, "Cab? What's the matter, Doc? Don't you drive?" Well, in those days, you could buy a Ford for $500. A Maxwell was about $550, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you want to buy that for? Add another $100 and buy a Dodge. You don't want a Dodge. For $1,200, you can buy a Buick. So then you can buy a mom, and they'd run you up into a Pierce Arrow. That was the most expensive car on the market then. So when we came home, this one day, it was shortly after we were married, my wife said to me, "Why don't we buy a car?" I said to her, "When I come back from the office today, I'll tell you why we don't buy a car." We had a neighbor whose husband was the furrier at McCreary's. That was a department store long before your time, on Wood Street. And he had a heart attack and died very suddenly. And he drove a National automobile. That was the name of the maker.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very big car, very expensive car. And he left her with a $2,000 policy and four kids. And she couldn't afford to run the car. And she was spending her insurance money to support the four kids. And finally, her brother had to come from New York and take them to New York to live with him. He had nothing to go on. I said to my wife when I came home, I said, "You know how much? I've got all the figures here. I stopped at a Buick. To drive a Buick, figure depreciation, the cost of driving it, gas, housing it. We didn't have a garage in our house, garage so on, would cost approximately $900 a year. Now I want to ask you a question. If you use cabs as much as you want to, can you get along on $150 a year? That's $12 a month, $12.50 a month." She says, "Oh, sure, I don't use that many cabs." I said, "Oh, see, cabs were cheap then."
Yeah.
I said, "Okay. Now I'll tell you why we don't buy a car. $900 a year, if you allow yourself $150 a year for cabs, it leaves me with $750. You know what I can do with $750? I can carry $30,000 worth of life insurance. And I'll feel that in case I die suddenly, you'll have something to go on. I don't want the same thing to happen to you that happened to Mrs. Kendall. So she says, well, you don't have to carry $30,000 worth. I said, all right, I'll cut it down to 20. So that's what I did. Mm-hmm. And we never bought a car. Because as I accumulated a little money, I started to buy some stocks, bonds, through the years. And now with the terrific expense that I have, you know, I don't know.